morning. We have three cases today in our second day of the October arguments. And we want to welcome Brookfield Central High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming and thank you for standing. You may be seated. And we also have University of Wisconsin Legal Studies students. Would they please rise? Are you with the undergraduates? Good. Well, welcome. You may be seated. The high school students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. We invite students to come, listen to oral argument, and then meet with a justice after the second oral argument. Everyone's invited to that meeting, and the discussion is on procedural matters, how we take cases, just hear oral argument, decide cases, and then release opinions. The discussion is not about the substantive issues in these cases. The students have gotten material about the case, and if anyone would like a summary of the facts and legal issues involved here, if you'd raise your hand, we could give you a summary. Right? Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He is the justice who's been assigned to meet with the students today. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
Good morning.
To her right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With these introductions made, I'll call the first case today, 2013 AP 578, State versus Ronald, and is it Knipper or Knipper? Okay. Arguing on behalf of the defendant is Donald T. Lang, Assistant State Public Defender. You will have 25 minutes, as you know, Mr. Lang. Noet, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, has 30 minutes representing the state. And then, Mr. Lang, you get 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, Attorney Lang.
Good morning. May it please the court, Don Lang appearing on behalf of the respondent appellant petitioner Ronald Knipper. This matter is an appeal from an order denying a petition for discharge. At issue is whether the Daubert Reliability Standard adopted in 2011 Wisconsin Act 2, which established a more demanding test for the admissibility of expert testimony, applies to the discharge trials of some 980 petitioners who petitioned after the effective date of the act, and if so, whether the failure to apply this to other petitioners can be justified simply because the date the original petition for commitment was filed. In this case, Mr. Knipper's petition for discharge was filed in May of 2012, well over a year after the effective date of the provision. Nevertheless, the trial court declined to consider the merits of his Daubert challenge to three lines of testimony, concluding that inasmuch as the original petition for commitment was filed way back in 2002, the new Daubert standard didn't apply to his discharge trial because it was merely a continuation of the original commitment. Mr. Knipper's position today is that the construction of the applicability provision of Act 2, adopted by the trial court below and adopted by the appellate courts in Knipper and Mr. Alger, is flawed in at least three ways. First, the decision rests on the faulty premise that a discharge proceeding is merely a continuation of the original commitment trial, rather than constituting, as it is, a discrete procedural and substantive hearing that is initiated by the filing of a petition for discharge. Second, the lower court's construction of the applicability provision simply produces absurd results. And basically, we're left with a situation where we have a dual system of admissibility that applies to some discharge petitioners, but not other discharge petitioners. And so, as a result, you could have a situation where a discharge petitioner in one court could be denied discharge based on expert testimony that would not be allowed in the courtroom next door simply because of the date the original petition for commitment was filed.
That's
Mr.
true.
Wang, what difference do you think it would have made here, whether or not Daubert was or was not in effect? Was there going to be any real difference in the testimony?
Well, we don't know because they never conducted the Daubert hearing to scrutinize the admissibility of the testimony.
Was there any offer of proof?
There was an offer of proof in the written motions, but it was never addressed, nor was there subsequent testimony or a request for the submission of affidavits. I think the standard now, and I rely in part on Professor Blinka's discussion of how Daubert will apply, the court can address this in a variety of ways by taking depositions or taking testimony, by accepting reports, by accepting affidavits, and then making the decision. The procedure doesn't necessarily require an evidentiary hearing, but it may. In this case, the court simply didn't engage in that process. And I think that goes to the remedy here. We're not asking that the discharge order be reversed and be granted a new discharge trial. I think at this point what we do is we remand for the Daubert hearing that should have been conducted. If the court concludes after that Daubert hearing that all of this testimony would have come in anyway, then there's no reason to have a new discharge trial.
But I maybe misunderstood Justice Crooks's question, but if it isn't his question, it was mine. What did you want not to come in that did come in? What did you think would not have come in with Daubert?
There are three lines of testimony. One is the diagnosis was challenged because the diagnosis of paraphilia NOS non-consent, because it's not reflected in the DSM manual, even the most recent one. It has been, in fact, affirmatively rejected as a diagnosis. The second line is the risk percentages that were applied by placing Mr. Knipper in this high-risk, high-need subgroup. The claim is that there's been no peer review of the validity of this particular categorization, nor, in fact, has there been any determination whether people who rate these individuals reach consistent results, inter-rater reliability. And, in fact, I think the state's own expert acknowledges a person could theoretically fit more than one of these groups. So then you end up with the question of how does one know which one to put the individual in. And then the third line of testimony entails an extrapolation from what the data is to take into account supposedly unreported sexual assaults. And the premise for this theoretically is that there are a vast number of unreported offenses, so therefore we can somehow assume that the risk for this guy is actually considerably higher. Well, the problem is, of course, the basis for this information about unreported incidents doesn't break down whether these incidents involve first-time offenders or, as we can address in 980 litigation, whether it's somebody who's been convicted, confined, and then released. And that's a big difference. What we're focused on in 980s is whether this person will recidivate, not whether they will commit that first offense. And we know this from our own study of the news, the priest, the football coach, whoever, may go on for years committing offenses. And so there will be a vast number of these. But once they're convicted and sentenced, there's a whole different probability that they're going to commit other offenses. And so the use of this extrapolation is challenged in this Daubert motion. Again, we don't have the benefit of what the hearing would look like, breaking down the specifics of this. And the court, of course, didn't rule on that.
Thank you.
You know, one...
If I may, the state's witness diagnosed the defendant with paraphilia, not otherwise specified non-consent. And you say that's wrong.
That is the contention in the Daubert motion, and it's predicated on the fact that the DSM has rejected recognition of that as an independent mental illness.
What did the defendant's witness say?
That's basically what the defense witness said during the course of the trial. There was an alternative diagnosis proffered in this case of antisocial personality disorder and some other, you know, forms of paraphilia, phone calls, exposing himself.
So the defense witness diagnosed paraphilia?
Yeah, as to two forms that aren't predisposing mental disorders, and that's the making obscene phone calls and indecent exposure kinds of conduct. And under Chapter 980, those don't qualify because they don't entail sexually violent conduct. Okay. In terms of this disparate treatment and this dual system of evidentiary admissibility that's created by the construction that the courts below have adopted, to add insult to injury, not only could an individual be denied discharge based on evidence that's not reliable enough to be offered in the courtroom next door, but this disparity in treatment will persist for years and indeed potentially decades to come. And not only is that an unfair situation for the person who's confined, but it poses sort of a procedural burden on the lawyers who 20 years from now, 30 years from now, in fact, lawyers who may not even be born now will have to discern what the evidentiary standard was for these prior cases.
I think Justice Bradley has
Thank
a question.
You.
Disparate treatment happens all the time when we have a change in evidentiary rules. I think that it was in the Court of Appeals opinion, maybe in the next case, perhaps it's in this case, that has a laundry list of evidentiary rules taking effect and before and after there is disparate treatment. But for lack of a better legal phrase, that comes with the territory. 1974, rules of evidence then. 76, wholesale change in rules of civil procedure. Disparate treatment before the effective date. So what makes this disparate treatment so special?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's easy to get caught up suggesting this is a retroactivity question, and it's not. This is a selective, prospective application of an evidentiary rule. The rule has been established, but we're applying it to some people prospectively, but not others prospectively. And there's simply no rational basis to draw this line. There's no link between the original commitment date and the evidentiary considerations or the procedural considerations that are taking place at a subsequent discharge trial.
I note that you responded to my question using the phrase rational basis. And, of course, that is an issue that's that you brief, starting on page 32, if I recall, of your brief here, and that is, what do we deal with? Is it rational basis or strict scrutiny? And you indicate that there is a liberty interest at stake in your discussion continues. So why did you say rational basis?
Because we don't need to get beyond that, because there is no rational basis to apply this evidentiary rule to some 980 petition for discharge patients, but not others. I think, as Mr. Phillips pointed out in the Alger brief at some length, it makes some sense, perhaps, to have a starting point which doesn't include litigation that's ongoing and currently in the midstream of litigation, because people, especially scientific evidence cases are going to have invested considerable resources preparing in reliance upon what the rules were at the particular time. That consideration simply doesn't come into play here because the 980 discharge process is discrete, independent, both procedurally and substantively from the original commitment. And so, you know, I submit still that strict scrutiny ought to be applied because this is indeed a liberty interest, and the particular distinction that's drawn here goes to the very heart and substance of the fact-finding process. But I don't think we even need to get there. In fact, I don't think we need to consider the constitutional question at all if we simply apply the plain language and apply the Daubert rule to any petition for discharge filed after the defective date.
Okay, Mr. Lang, you started out saying you had, I think, three positions. One, as I hear you, is just interpret the state statute. And that's the one you say that if you don't interpret the way the defendant says, you get to the absurd result. Okay. Your second argument, as I hear it, is that there's no rational basis for the legislature to not apply the new rule to this proceeding. And the third argument I hear is you apply strict scrutiny to the statute because you have a liberty interest, and under strict scrutiny, it's unconstitutional not apply it here. Are those your arguments?
The strict scrutiny we don't even need to get to because it won't survive rational basis. We don't even need to get to rational basis because if you just apply the plain language, this should solve the issue.
Okay, well, let's get to the plain language. What's the plain language here that you're relying on?
That it basically applies to any action commenced on the date of this.
Okay. Is this an action?
Yeah, indeed it is. And defining action is a little tricky because it's never really defined anywhere.
Well, that's my point.
But Black's Law Dictionary has basically defined it as any lawsuit that ends in a judgment.
Okay. And, by judgment, you mean order. Order or judgment.
Order or judgment, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, is it a special proceeding?
Well, it's interesting because the statute defines an action to include special proceedings unless it's not as
that's
why indicated I'm otherwise.
The question, what's a special proceeding?
And it seems to be a special proceeding generally involves something that involves non-participants in the initial lawsuit. For instance, we had a criminal case and the Milwaukee Journal wanted to have access to a PSI report because they felt the public had a right to know, and they file a request for that document, that might be a special proceeding, as opposed to an action, because the action would be the actual lawsuit. The cases that talk about this, there's State Expo Henderson versus Ramish, which was a PLR case, and trying to figure out the difference between an action and a claim. And essentially, an action is considered the whole lawsuit, whereas a claim are subparts to the lawsuit. And most of the cases that have talked about action at all have discussed this distinction between subparts of the lawsuit and the lawsuit itself.
Well, why isn't this a subpart? It has the same case number as the original trial has.
Yeah, and I think this is the faulty premise on which Alger is based, and that is there's this myth that this is an ongoing proceeding, and it simply is not. Once the final judgment committing the person is entered, he goes off to Sand Ridge, and in fact, there will be absolutely no other court proceedings ever unless the petitioner files a petition for discharge. The department can also file requests for supervised release, but in fact, the court has absolutely no role unless a petition is filed. So if a guy loves getting his three squares and a place to stay, he can basically not participate in treatments in his bed and watch TV all day and never appear in court again. That the court's role here is purely passive. The department does the exam every year, which they're required to do for due process purposes. The report gets sent to the court, but the court has absolutely no responsibility to review it, see it, do anything to it. In fact, the only way anything gets started is if the petitioner files a petition for discharge. So not only procedurally does the thing not ongoing, it ends with a final appealable judgment, the procedure for the new proceeding is separate and distinct. It requires the petitioner to file a new petition for discharge, and substantively speaking, he has to allege something new that wasn't considered at the prior proceeding. And in this respect, this is much different than a criminal 97406 or other challenge to the original judgment. The discharge process, in effect, precludes a challenge to the original action. It is focused on the defendant's condition at this particular time.
Counsel, as a former trial judge, there are case types that may be analogous here. And one, of course, is discussed at length, and that is Chapter 51, mental commitments. We also have guardianships that the court retains jurisdiction of, oftentimes for years. And that experience, now this is not nuanced that I'm speaking of, I'm just saying generally. And so that experience lulls me into saying, well, you know, that's what we do. We're used to that. The guardianship, the mental commitments, these are somewhat analogous, and that's the way we handle them as a continuation of the original proceeding. Can you respond to that? Other than get over it, judge?
Well, apart from the fact, this is final and this is separate. Whether that's done in some other context, begs the question of whether this was a final action and whether the discharge process commences a new action. Now, in the Chapter 51-55 context, part of the public policy is to provide a continuous course of treatment and care. So, in effect, we treat the person as opposed to 980s, which have multiple public policy concerns. One is protecting the public, which has been this dual consideration throughout. So it raises additional due process concerns on the part of the patient, who is being held not necessarily by treatment because he doesn't have to do treatment, but because he's also being confined to protect the public. And the question is, does the government get to protect the public by keeping this guy locked up? And that's why we have an independent discharge trial periodically to assure that he meets the criteria that permits the government to do this. And it is always based on his condition now, not his condition at the time of the original commitment or in one of the preceding discharge trials.
Suppose the court doesn't agree with you that a discharge petition is a new action. That's the way I'm leading. But you have some excellent arguments. How do you help someone like me?
Well, then we get to the problem, to construe that what I consider the plain language, I don't even think there's ambiguity here. It's an action, and it's new. It's filed after the state, so it's covered by the statute. And if we use rules of statutory construction that consider the totality of the statute, the 980 proceeding, and the absurd results that follow by having a dual system of admissibility that persists in perpetuity for the particular patients, only then do we get to the constitutional question. And I think there's just no rational basis to treat two 980 patients who could be in the same treatment program, in the same facility, in next-door rooms, and yet when they go to court, one could be detained based on evidence that wouldn't be admissible in the other patient's discharge trial. You know, this cuts both ways, in fact, because the state theoretically could end up in a discharge trial where the defense brings in somebody who has dubious science, but it's believed, and he's discharged for reasons that's not based on reliable evidence. It's inconceivable to me, quite honestly, what interest the government could potentially have that would allow unreliable evidence in some cases but not others. Because we don't want to hold people longer than they should be, and constitutionally we're not permitted to, And of course, finally, we don't want to prematurely release somebody based on evidence that's not reliable either. There's simply no evidentiary link, again, between the discharge trial and the original commitment. They're separate, discrete inquiries based on current circumstances, current science, current new information. And in fact, if the defense or the patient doesn't come up with some new information, he doesn't even get a discharge trial. He's got to present something new.
But the general rule is the legislature can pick a date, effective date, just like fix the age 18 or 17 or 25. You know, there's no particular rational basis for any one of those, but you got to have a date. You got to have an age, so the legislature picks it.
Yeah, the question is whether the legislature can draw a line. It's whether, one, they drew the line that's been suggested by the decisions below, and two, whether or not that line, to the extent it's drawn, is constitutionally permissible or creates an unreasonable distinction between two similarly situated 980 patients. I mean, we look at the legislative history, there's no mention whatsoever of Chapter 980 litigation, and it's fair to assume that the legislature probably didn't think about, well, how is the Daubert standard going to apply to future 980 discharge trials when the original commitment was filed before this date? I mean, there's just no indication that was on the radar. And these collection of bills that were passed as Wisconsin Act 2 were designed to prevent nuisance lawsuits, to reduce exposure of especially products liability manufacturers who could be exposed to big judgments or expensive trials based on essentially junk science, that an expert with a degree and an opinion could come in and the defendant would be entitled, or the litigant would be entitled to his day in court. Discussion of the implications of this on 980 discharge trials isn't addressed anywhere. And
well, 980 is neither civil nor criminal, but has both. It's civil, but it has a lot of criminal issues in it, in the sense of liberty and in the sense that it stems from a criminal trial. But my recollection is that the state and others didn't want Daubert to apply to criminal actions, and they said, legislature said, applies across the board. Right?
Well, yeah, the statute only refers to civil action, so one could infer it took effect the day it was became effective in criminal actions. And there would be, I mean, the general rule is a procedure rule applies retroactively unless it's indicated otherwise or it would pose some undue burden to people's rights. And here, certainly, there's nothing about applying this. And again, it's not retroactive, it's prospectively. And that's where we have this oddity, is we have a prospective application to some individuals but not others. And the reason why? Well, because their original petition was fortuitously filed on a date before this, even though there's no logical evidentiary connection between those two events. I mean, we're not asking this court to overturn or second-guess a legislative judgment about the wisdom of not applying Daubert to discharge trials for one group over another, because that kind of fact-finding never occurred anywhere based on the record that's available. And frankly, again, seeing no rational basis for such a distinction, it's hard to imagine that any fact-finding could have occurred. And with that, I will sit down.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Lang. And one of the questions I'm going to ask you is, how is this different than the next case? What's different about this case than the next case? Assistant Attorney General Nowak, Nancy Nowak, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. First, I'd like to thank everyone for agreeing to have me here all day today. I regret that decision. I'd like to start first by making a couple of what I think are general observations. The Daubert statute applies beyond Chapter 980. It applies to all civil actions, and criminal actions, I believe, at this point are going to be swept in as well. And so this Court's decision most likely will have broad ramifications beyond Chapter 980. Now, admittedly, there are certain nuances unique to Chapter 980 that we'll be talking about, but we go far beyond Chapter 980 when we're talking about the Daubert statute. Second, I don't think anyone in this room, let alone Mr. Knipfer or anyone else, can say credibly that there has been some sort of seismic shift in how we analyze and admit expert testimony, either in Chapter 980 or beyond, because of the Daubert statute. We just don't know that at this point. It is a rule of evidence. As an attorney who was a prosecutor in Milwaukee and handled expert testimony well before Daubert was even thought of as coming into play here in Wisconsin, I will tell you I don't see a substantial difference in how Daubert hearings are going to happen as opposed to the pre-Daubert hearings. I think courts have long looked at expert testimony as to whether it was relevant and appropriate to come in, and I'm not so sure that the analysis changes all that much under Daubert. And certainly no one can sit here today and say, my goodness, this is a dramatic shift. It's huge.
You know, the studies of the federal proceedings pre- and post-Daubert is that judges are more gatekeepers and more testimony, scientific or, quote, expert testimony, doesn't come in and never gets to the fact finder. That's what I think the studies have shown. So the federal courts have had the most experience with Daubert, I think. And there's dispute as to whether it's a seismic shift, but I don't think there's a dispute that there's some shift. Now, whether or not judges and prosecutors and lawyers in this state are making the shift is another issue. But I think that it's a significant shift. I don't know that you can get in under Daubert guidance counselors as experts, for example, which appear quite frequently in child sex cases.
I don't know that they're necessarily excludable. I agree with you. Certainly the standard has changed.
Okay.
But again, you know, in looking at federal law, and Daubert did not work a sea change over federal evidence law. That's a quote that comes up a lot in the Daubert discussion. And I think even the Daubert rule as we have it now remains, in essence, a rule of exception. It is not favored to throw out expert testimony. And certainly, counsel got some questions about what exactly did he expect to exclude in this case. And I think what he offered in support of his argument was opinions from his own expert. The fact that there are contradictory expert opinions in a case doesn't mean that any are thrown out. There's cross-exam left at trial, and it's a reliability standard, and despite that analysis, I think most often the expert testimony, or much of it, will continue to be admissible.
Do you expect this court to gauge that and decide that, it was good testimony under Daubert, it was good testimony pre-Daubert, and that it's really all harmless error? Is that the state's argument?
Harmless error, I think the state's argument here, I mean, obviously, I assume we'll get into this, as to whether this is a new action, this being a petition for discharge.
I assume that's the real point of this case.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And I bring up the point about Daubert not being such a seismic shift because I think it gives appropriate perspective to the discussion. Because, of course, ultimately we're going to be talking about, well, what is the rational basis for this statute, aren't we? And I think the answer is...
Not the rational basis of the statute, the rational basis of applying it to a 980 case that arose before, 980 commitment that arose before February 1, 2011.
Yes.
That's what the rational basis is.
That's right.
Okay.
And so we're going to be talking about, well, what is that rational basis? And I think it's important to have the context that I laid out, and that's why I made that observation.
Thank you.
And so, since I brought it up, let's talk about that. What would be the rational basis? And obviously it is the state's position that that is the appropriate level of review for the statute here and its applicability more specifically.
What's the rational basis?
To say it in a few words, it's simple. And that's important. Counsel has conceded that applying Daubert midstream, so to speak, would be confusing, would result in essentially an apples-to-oranges fight about, you know, pre-Daubert preparation, experts already teed up for trial, whether it be on an original commitment or, in this case, a petition for discharge, and then shifting everything. That's unfair. It's confusing. We ought not do that. Chapter 980, to say Chapter 980 proceedings are unique, I think, is a gross understatement. I think we all know Chapter 980 is its own animal. And in that context, the petitions for discharge are not, they're not new and more important and specific to the point of this apples and oranges discussion I'd like to have is evidence that was admitted pre-Daubert continues or certainly can continue to be both relevant and admissible after Daubert. A great example, I think, is when a court considers whether a petitioner is eligible for supervised release. And that is, I'll find the appropriate statutory reference here. ...980-08, and specifically sub 4 and then CG, the court may not authorize supervised release unless, based on all of the reports, trial records, and evidence presented, the court finds all of the following criteria. And those criteria deal with progress in treatment, whether it is substantially probable the person will not engage in further acts of sexual violence, treatment for the person's needs, and that the person can reasonably be expected to comply. But I think what's relevant there is pre-Daubert expert evidence is still relevant. It's still going to come in. And then if we apply Daubert to a petition for discharge, aren't we inviting confusion? Aren't we inviting attorneys to fight about apples and oranges? When a judge is making a decision here as to supervised release, are we going to have defense attorneys stepping in and saying, oh, judge, okay, I understand the statute mandates that you consider everything, including pre-Daubert expert evidence, but don't weigh it as much because now we've got post-Daubert materials, and that counts more. Or throw that out. Or, my goodness, there's error here because the judge placed too much evidence on pre-Daubert evidence and inappropriately discounted post, or vice versa. That's why I think there's a rational basis for the legislature to have said, this is the cutoff. And when you have a continuing action, and it is the state's position that this is a continuing action, it's simple. You start with the first petition for commitment, that date when the order is entered, that's your standard. If you come after Daubert, it's that standard. It's simple. It's rational. And it avoids the fight over apples and oranges.
When was Mr. Knipfer committed?
I believe it was 2002, but it was certainly well before Daubert was passed.
And was he committed when the experts were using static -99?
That I'm afraid I don't know. I couldn't be specific on the static 99 and whether that was applicable in 2002. I apologize. But again, I think.
But
that
would it be fair to say that he wasn't committed using static 99R?
I believe that's a relatively new actuarial. If I can call it that, but yes, I think it's fair to say that.
But static 99R was used in the discharge petition, wasn't it?
Yes, I believe it was.
Okay. Why isn't that changing the evidence in midstream?
Well, rules, the actuarials change often in these contexts. Is it changing midstream? I mean, that's a change we're all going to have to live with, I think, as science hopefully improves, but if nothing else changes, we deal with the new science. And certainly when petitioners have new science available to them, you know, such that perhaps their diagnoses changes. Perhaps they are now eligible for discharge or supervised release when they weren't previously. That's a change separate and apart from the procedure and the standards. And the question, of course, circles back. Does Daubert apply to the expert, whichever expert opinion you're talking about, whether it be the old 99 or the 99R, is it Daubert, is it not Daubert? And in the scenario you laid out, and the difference in time, the difference in the actuarials, then again, don't we come back and fight about, well, the old pre-Daubert 99, I mean, there's a separate question on the 99 versus the 99R, but it's pre-Daubert, so discount it, Judge. Versus the 99R is post-Daubert, so count it more. That's the fight I'm talking about.
Well, the judges are accustomed to that kind of dispute and analysis of evidence. I'm thinking that in a different context on drunk driving, where you got multiple counts and they increase, that we have multiple offenses and convictions, it increases the penalty, right? And but you can, the judge can go back and look at prior convictions and say they're invalid because you didn't have a lawyer. And that therefore you can't count them. So judges know how to do that. This is not new to the judge of being able to evaluate. And if you've got somebody in for 10 years, shouldn't you look at one of the early reports and say, you know, that wouldn't hold up now, and so I'm not going to count that as much as I'm going to count last year's report that's really strong and says he should stay in. I think judges know how to do that.
Well, I think judges in general would do that. I mean, as a practical matter, certainly a newer report, I think we'd all agree you might put more stock in it just because it's new, it's fresh,
sure,
right?
Sure.
And yet, don't you want to avoid the fight? Say the judge is perfectly adept at saying, well, you know, that's older, it's pre-Daubert, maybe it doesn't wash today. That's fine, I accept that. But what about when counsel brings an objection? And I would hope we'd all agree that a petition for discharge isn't an invitation, nor is it allowed for someone to go back and challenge the original commitment order or prior proceedings.
No, but it's a manner of evaluating whether the person should be discharged or released under supervision now. And I think you're absolutely right. The statutes indicate that the judge is to look at the whole record.
Yes.
Including the original offense and the original thing. And therefore has to weigh all of this. So the judge is perfectly capable of weighing. And who has an interest in this? Well, I think the state has an interest in this because the state is detaining somebody and removing that person from society or placing him in a different society against his will. And the state should be favoring liberty interests. And I think that the defendant, the committee has an interest because he wants out. So he doesn't care whether it's apples and oranges. He wants everything considered in a fruit salad.
Of course. But notwithstanding the judge's ability to weigh evidence appropriately, the apples and oranges, I think, pertains more to the fighting that goes on outside of that. What happens when there's a motion? Judge, leave it out. Don't consider it. I don't care what the statute says. Don't consider the pre-Daubert materials. Or on appeal afterward. The judge erred. The judge got it wrong because pre-Daubert and post-Daubert are different animals. The judge did apples and oranges, and more important, he or she did it wrong. That's the kind of fight I think we're inviting. And as you pointed out earlier, there has to be a cutoff somewhere,
mm-hmm.
Right? Some people get left out. Some people don't. Largely, is that luck of the draw because the date when a new statute comes into effect? Yes. It happens. It happens all the time. But more important in this context, I mean, you know, are we really talking about a situation where there's no rational basis? Now, admittedly, it may seem, I don't mean to be cute by saying it's simple to do it this way, but I think it is. Are there going to be a vast number of cases where we have, you know, lots of confusion? Again, I think that's the question mark.
How many people are in Sandridge now that were their original proceedings were prior to 2011?
I can't give you an exact number. I believe in one of the briefs in the cases submitted here, there was a footnote that spoke of perhaps a few hundred or I think less than that that would be fall in that category, but I don't know the answer.
It's going to be most of them.
It could be. It could be. I believe Sandridge holds about 300 or so patients.
So, you know, another way of figuring it is how many 980s per year. Do you know that? Okay. All right. I don't eat them.
Then I'm in good stead.
You advance the simplicity, and, of course, a lot of us enjoy approach that is has some simplicity. But why not this approach that's simple? Because in a 980, we're looking at, if a person meets the criteria for commitment now, why not apply the criteria for evidence that is in effect now? I mean, why we're looking at him now, but we're looking applying the old, you know, the wine that's in the old vessels?
Because glad you brought up old wine and new bottles, because that was
I said old vessels.
Old vessels, excuse me. But a similar discussion was had, I assure you. I think I come back again to the point I made with the supervised release analysis. The old wine is still relevant and it comes in. That's the problem. Is you're not just under post-Daubert at that point. And if you are, boy, aren't you in trouble? Because you've got expert evidence that you're considering that wasn't subject to Daubert. So,
you know, I don't think it's that. You use terms like seismic and sea change. Well, there's something between not so big a deal and seismic and sea change, you know, and maybe that's where we are. I'm not sure that Daubert is seismic and a sea change, but I think it's kind of a big deal. We've been fighting about it for years. We have cases where we haven't accepted Daubert, and now we have Daubert. You know, sometimes we fight for naught one way or the other, but people have thought it was a big deal, even if it wasn't seismic. I remember as a circuit court judge, oftentimes, two things. Oftentimes, number one, I'd say, given the law, well, I'll let it in, you know, your objection goes to the weight, not as to the admissibility. Boy, I'd say that with regard to witnesses, as particularly expert witnesses, with great frequency, because that's what judges actually were supposed to do, let it go to the jury. You know, it's admissible, your objection goes to the weight, it's going to come in. You know, so that's, I won't get to my second point because I don't, the second point is this. There was an attorney in where I was practicing. When he came to expert witnesses, he always wanted an expert that wore trousers and never wanted one that would wear a three-piece suit. And I'm concerned that Daubert is going to require three-piece suits, and those folks that would come in some kind of work trousers are no longer going to be considered to have the necessary scientific knowledge or expertise. What do you say about that when you say, oh, it's good enough, it isn't good enough?
I say I don't know. And if you push me, do I think standing here today that I'll speak first from the state's perspective, that any significant number of the state's expert in these cases is going to be subject to challenge and possible exclusion under Daubert? No, I don't.
You don't think so? I was at a seminar when the state folks were expressing concern about some of the kind of witnesses, like social workers, that they used to have testify and maybe still do in sexual assault that maybe couldn't make some of the same opinions under Daubert. Is that
all ironed out?
I
think there is some concern, obviously, but do I think it's going to really keep out a significant chunk of experts? I don't. I don't know that that's shown yet anyway. I don't think that's the case. And by the way, I think it makes a good point. You know, the defense may rue the day that they prevail on this point in this court, because certainly their experts are going to be subject to that new standard as well, and farther back if they have their way today. So it's a question mark. But again, you know, we circle back. I fear that too. No one in this room wants appropriate, reliable expert testimony thrown out ever. I mean, I don't think anyone's advocating for that. And I certainly hope that that won't happen.
I know, but you need a test for reliability.
Absolutely. And we have it.
And it's Daubert.
Yes.
And that's different than the old test of whether it's relevant.
It is certainly stated differently in the statute. Absolutely. Do I expect it to operate differently? I presume it will. How much differently?
We don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think anybody does.
The legislature made a decision, right?
Yes.
That it wants it to operate at least under that new standard of new Daubert.
It did.
Okay.
In disagreement with this court. But the legislature did, in fact, make that decision. And as I said, they picked the state. And I think the apples and oranges analysis I made is the rational basis here from the state's perspective.
It seems to me, as I understand your argument, if we apply Daubert, you fear that these gunslingers here are going to try to open up all sorts of past cases or challenge evidence in past cases. Am I right?
I do not believe they have the ability to go back and challenge prior proceedings, prior orders, whether they be the original commitment order or subsequent orders denying petitions, plural, if you will, for discharge. No, I don't think they can do that, and I don't think they would succeed if they tried. I think the difference, the discrepancy, is that the pre-Daubert evidence upon which either a petitioner was committed originally or which came in as part and parcel of a petition for discharge or for supervised release remains relevant, and it continues to come in even on a petition for discharge that comes after that date. I agree with Justice Abrahamson that certainly the new reports, so to speak, I mean, wouldn't we all, if we opened a file, and these files are big, you've seen them, wouldn't we all look at the newer ones first? Sure. But the court's required to look at the older ones, too, and consider them. They remain relevant, they remain evidence, and they continue to come in. And so why have people fighting? Why have lawyers fighting? You don't want to see any more of us up here arguing about whether judges
hear. Yes, we do. That's what we get paid to do.
Paid to be here. But that,
and that's what you get paid
all
to
day.
Do.
We want a little variety, okay, don't we? Right. It is the spice of life.
Right.
It's, let's have a decision and then move on. Of
What's
course.
The difference between this?
He was sorry.
It seems to me, if I understand the defendant's counsel's case, they're really challenging, or at least in this case, they're really challenging the new evidence, not the old evidence. And I'm having a little trouble why the new evidence shouldn't be evaluated under the new procedure. I'm with you on the old evidence.
Well, because if the new evidence is evaluated under the new procedure, and then it is considered, and again, I'll circle back to the decision on a petition for supervised release, and it is considered then along with, as it is required to be, pre-Daubert expert evidence, then you're mixing the apples and oranges, and then you're inviting people to fight about what counts more, what the judge ought to consider, what the judge ought not to consider. Did the judge err in giving too much weight to the pre-Daubert report that he considered? And I see my yellow light is on, so we're under 5 minutes. But that's the apples and oranges fight that I'm addressing, and that's, I think, the rational basis for cutting things off where the legislature did.
What's the difference between this case and the next one?
Little, if anything. I think the issues are, I think they're essentially identical. I couldn't articulate for you a substantive difference. And so if that's of any consolation, I'll be, I think, speaking far less on the next one.
All right. Thank you.
And with that, if there are no further questions, I'll sit down.
Any other questions? You think this is all rational basis, then never get to strict scrutiny.
That's correct. I don't know how Mr. Knipfer could make an argument that he has a fundamental right to a rule of evidence. And if that were the case, wouldn't all of his pre-Daubert proceedings, including his original commitment, be subject to challenge? That's not a claim he's making.
But I don't know if he's – it's all a matter of how you frame it. That's right. How you – what lens you look through and how you frame the issue. I don't think he's saying that he has a fundamental right to a rule of evidence. In fact, he says this, that he has a fundamental, page 32, liberty interest at stake. He's not saying a rule of evidence, only in this way, that liberty, obviously, if you're committed to 980, I mean, you're really talking about whether you're in or out.
Sure.
And he says that it plays such a significant role in determining whether you're in and out, that it isn't a mere rule of evidence, but it's substantive. That's his argument, at least in part.
But to get to strict scrutiny, and I don't think you get there. I think it is a rule of evidence. We're not talking about Chapter 980 and how it functions substantively in terms of putting someone into a commitment or continuing a commitment. And I think that was the gist of the Mary, is it Mary F.R. Case, comparing Chapter 51 to Chapter 980, and they said there, look, we're not denying someone the right to a jury trial. It's just you have six instead of 12, and there are rational differences for that. And so it's not a challenge to Chapter 980 itself. It's a challenge to a rule of evidence, and that's – I think he has to say he has a right, fundamental right to this rule of evidence to get to strict scrutiny.
The response in his brief to that is, hey, this isn't just a matter of number of jurors. This goes to the very essence of whether I'll be committed. But what's the response? I mean, I don't really
And again, this doesn't mean expert evidence doesn't come in or is excluded necessarily. It's a rule of evidence, and I think that's where he's wrong in that respect. This is not denying either side the right to get in expert testimony. This is just a rule of evidence, a reliability standard for that testimony, and that's not a fundamental right. It exposed there.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lang.
Addressing the first point, yes, I also agree that Alger and Mr. Knipfer's cases are pretty much indistinguishable. For the same reasons Mr. Knipfer should be granted relief, so should Mr. Alger. I don't know that we can assume that Daubert has no impact on proceedings. Obviously, the legislature wouldn't have bothered to adopt the Daubert standard unless it thought it was important enough to change the screening mechanism for expert testimony. And to say otherwise ignores the longstanding history in this state that indicates that the role of the trial court is not to screen the reliability of testimony, but just the qualifications and relevance of the testimony. In fact, I've spent 30-plus years of a career foregoing potential appellate claims because, in the end, the reliability question was up to the finder of fact based on the conduct of the trial. The recognition was this unfortunately allows potentially unreliable evidence into the proceedings, and jurors aren't always necessarily equipped to do the screening process of a very persuasive charlatan with a degree in opinion. In terms of the little detour we took to supervised release proceedings, in a discharge proceedings, we're not going to have this apples and oranges battle over prior reports because the prior reports are not going to be relevant to the current discharge proceeding. Again, discharge proceedings are going to be based on new opinions that address the defendant's condition at this point in time. And so there simply is not going to be any apples and oranges debate. In fact, in supervised release proceedings...
Counsel, isn't Ms. Nowot right when she says that the judge will look through and is to look through the entire file?
For supervised release proceedings,
right.
Not for discharge proceedings, which we're talking about.
Right.
Now, just because he can look at other reports wouldn't preclude that in the current proceeding, in a supervised release proceeding, one couldn't raise a Daubert challenge that this information you're relying upon now, today, isn't reliable. You can't collaterally attack a prior proceeding that was based on that report, but certainly there's no reason to allow unreliable information to dictate the result of a current proceeding. Quite frankly, the simpler solution here is not to just, not apply this to some discharge proceedings, but apply it in others, but it's simply to apply it in all discharge proceedings that were filed after the effective date of the statute. It is not only simpler, it is fairer. It is not only simpler, it reads reliable results. Reliable results using a system the legislature has determined necessary in place of the old, minimal relevancy test. Question was raised, how many people does this impact? Footnote I put in indicates how many guys are there and the number that go in each year, so you can infer that it's the most people at Sand Ridge are there due to an original commitment that occurred prior to the effective date. In fact, the question was raised about the original date of the static 99. Frankly, there are lots of guys at Sand Ridge who were committed under a scheme where there were no actuarials at all. When this bill was first passed, we had experts come in and sort of this ipse dixit kind of testimony. Well, there's a lot of factors out there, and I look at this guy, and he seems to have a lot of these 36 flavors, I think they called it at the time, or 37, whatever Baskin-Robbins was. And by looking at all these, I have no quantifiable data. I have no thing to measure it against, but he seems to have a lot of them, so therefore he qualifies. And that was the standard we used back at the original commitment days. In terms of this debate about apples and oranges and past reports, the fact is, again, in all discharge proceedings, it's going to be new reports, not old reports. And there's no reason to have a mechanism or a system that tolerates evidence that doesn't satisfy the Daubert standard.
Are you drawing a distinction between supervised release hearings and discharge proceedings?
Yeah, this is a discharge proceeding. Determination whether or not he still meets the standards for commitment. A supervised release proceeding involves this sort of intermediate assessment about does this guy, as a patient who's not qualified for release, should he be transferred to a non-custodial inpatient placement? And the considerations that are taken into account there are considerably different. They're much broader than the considerations in a discharge proceeding.
In your view, should the Daubert standard apply to the supervised release hearing?
Yeah, it should. Simply because past reports are considered doesn't mean past reports can't be scrutinized to determine whether they're reliable. I mean, the whole point of this is to have reliable proceedings, not to make it easy on us all. Final point, in terms of Mary F.R., the liberty interest here is the right to have one's liberty determined by reliable evidence. And we've got a system now we've determined that certain evidence is reliable or not reliable under Daubert. And it is unreasonable. In fact, it seems to violate strict scrutiny to let some guys have their discharge determined based on one set of evidence and other guys who are in the same program, same facility, subject to everything else that's identical, be subject to continued commitment based on evidence that otherwise couldn't be admitted. Request that the order be vacated and the matter be remanded for the Daubert hearing that should have been held. If the state's correct and it doesn't make much difference, then he's going to not get his new trial, discharge trial, if the court determines this all would otherwise be admissible. But that should be determined as a matter of findings by the trial court.
Thank you, counsel. That ends our first hearing on the Daubert statute. And thank you to Mr. Lang and thank you, Ms. Nowett. And we'll now proceed to the second, but we'll take a short break for those students who wish to leave. So we are in recess. Gives you about